This episode of the Joe and Carrie podcast is brought to you by FanDuel. Fantasy football for everyday fans. You got a new contest starting every week. No busted season. Something for everyone with lots of contests to choose from starting at just a buck. Just pick a contest, choose your team, watch your score real time. More than 2.5 million players have won a cash prize playing fantasy sports on FanDuel. Very, very easy to do. Go to FanDuel.com, click the Join Now button, and enter the promo code Jonah. That's FanDuel.com. Sign up with the promo code Jonah, and thank you to FanDuel for sponsoring the podcast. And this episode of the Jonah Carey podcast is with the great Shea Serrano. Shea Serrano is a freaking superstar. Self-made guy. Got into writing as basically a way to pay the bills. Liked writing, thought it'd be cool, but ultimately just needed to find a way to support his family. And has turned that and talent and hard work and all that good stuff into great, great things. Shea is the author of one New York Times bestselling book called The Wrap Yearbook. And he is on his way to another bestselling book that is basketball and other things he should hear in the next couple days. About the results of that, but sales have been through the roof. Really, really good, and Shea deserves all of it, all the credit in the world, and I love this book. It's super fun. I talked to him during the podcast. A little bit of Free Darko in there. Lots of, like, fun little essays in there. People remember the Free Darko days, and the illustrations are just great. Arturo Torres did a tremendous job. We talked about that. We talked about getting into the writing world and a zillion other things. Shea, also a writer, by the way, at The Ringer. Highly recommend that you read him and Ben Lindbergh and Michael Bauman and Mallory Rubin and a million zillion other people over there. Lots of my old pals at Grandland, and I wish them all the success of the universe, and I am happy for Shea that he is doing all these great things. Actually, the first time that we ever got to meet, despite the fact that we'd worked together at Grandland, so this was really cool, and he was nice enough to invite me into his home, and it was all very, very lovely. So, Shea, way to go, man. And thanks to him for coming on the pod. And thanks to you for listening to the pod. I hope you enjoy it. Jonah Carey is on the phone. Jonah Carey is on the phone. Hold on, we're listening to your intro. Jonah Carey is on the phone.
What we're doing it on?
That's literally what we're doing on.
That's cool. Shea Serrano. I didn't even know you could do that.
It's that easy. I'm, like, first of all, delighted to meet you. I've never met you, and I feel like that's kind of was the ethos of Grandland. Maybe it is with The Ringer too, that there's an office somewhere, but we were all like satellites and just kind of all over the place.
Right.
So this is exciting. I want to ask you, first of all, some of the questions, like, you've been asked obviously a bunch of times before, but I want to ask you about the path to writing, just because, if for no other reason, I'm so interested in it, because I was, like, the most traditional, well, not the most traditional, but I did go to journalism school and all that garbage, but I came to sports writing much later, and in your case, it was life circumstances. So, if you don't have, like, classical training, and you don't have, which I don't think I had either, really, but whatever, let's be honest, but if you don't, if you're just kind of starting from zero, is it scary? Are you like, oh, I'm totally going to fuck this up? Like, did you think, oh, like, I could totally make a go of this? Or was it just, I got to pay the bills, I'm going to do what I got to do?
Yeah, it was more of that last one.
Yeah.
We need some money, and that seemed like a way to get some money.
Yeah.
So I'll try that. It wasn't a, I wasn't, like, very nervous or whatever, because it wasn't a, like, a dream I was trying to chase down.
Interesting.
Or anything like that. It was just, I want to pay these bills, so I'll try it this way. And, yeah, it, I mean, it's scary. It's definitely, like, but more overwhelming than like, terrifying.
Yeah.
It feels like, for me, it was like I was standing at the foot of the ocean trying to figure out how to get across, is what it seemed like. But, you know, you just start picking up pieces and make a little tiny boat, and then you're off.
Did you have any kind of support system? Did you have, like, family members who were writers? Did you have a friend of a friend who was an editor somewhere? Did you have anybody you could bounce stuff off, or were you just, like, totally going to the ocean by yourself?
No, I didn't know anybody who had done that. Nobody in San Antonio on, like, our side of town was.
Yeah.
It's not. We didn't even know there was a job that you could do. I didn't even know it was a job you could do until I got offered one.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, I didn't know anybody. It was just a situation where I started looking on the internet or the newspapers, and I saw names, and like, okay, these people must be writers, so let me start emailing everybody and try to figure this out.
Yeah.
That's the cool thing about the internet, really, is like when you show up, nobody knows who you are or what you are. So if you just walk in like, I'm a writer, then people go, oh, that he's a writer, and you're off.
And we're jumping ahead a little bit, but I feel like that's one of the things, I mean, I try to do it myself, is just like reach out to other people who are trying to make it in this totally ridiculous business, which keeps getting harder and harder. Is that because you felt alone at the beginning? It's like, oh, if I can help this person, I totally will. Or is it building camaraderie, or what is it that you're like, oh, this person's a writer, I need to try to help them if I can.
You're talking about when I do it now?
Now, yeah.
Yeah, that's more of me just paying it forward.
That's cool.
For some people who did it in the beginning. Like the very first person who ever did that for me was a guy named Matt Sanzala, who he lives in Austin now with his family.
Mm-hmm.
He used to run like this hip hop stuff for South by Southwest and all this. But he was like the Texas rap writer that everybody sort of, they kept saying his name. So I found his website. I got in contact with him. I was asking if I could interview him because I had talked my way into like a press pass for this little festival that was happening in Houston called Screw Fest.
Yeah.
It was like a celebration of DJ Screw. So I told him, I was with a newspaper. They didn't even ask what newspaper. They were just very excited to have press come.
Yeah.
I got a pass, and then I found his website and I emailed him and asked if I could interview him. And maybe like the first 5 minutes were me interviewing him about DJ Screw, and then it just turned into me talking to him about being a writer. And we talked for like an hour, and we had never met or anything, but he just took that time to do that for me. And then he like connected me to an editor at the Houston Press. And I started going that way. But there were other people too, like Jay Busby. Who,
of course, Jay's great.
I never met him before, but I kept seeing his name on websites, so I emailed him, and he took some time to answer questions. Will Leach from...
Will's... I think Will might be the person I've had on the various iterations of my podcast the most.
Yeah.
Like 6 times. He's great.
He was super cool. You know, if you... This was 2008 or something like that, 2007.
Yeah.
So if you were on all of those sports blogs or reading them, you saw his
Deadspin,
name.
Deadspin, he's OG.
And then he was Deadspin. Everybody seemed to gravitate there, so I was like, well, let me talk to this guy.
Yeah.
And he gave me some really, like, some super strong advice at the time that I give people now today, because I was trying to figure out, oh, I want to write magazine covers for GQ or whatever, but I've never done before. And he said, you're never going to ever be able to do that. Like, pitch local stories to local papers.
Yeah.
And that's how you get in the game. And he was 100% right. That was the first time I started getting told yes. Like, I pitched covering a high school football game or high school basketball game to a neighborhood newspaper. And then they were like, yeah, we'll hire you. And then I was flipping it into bigger things. But that's why I do it now, because people like that, for no reason at all, and like not expecting anything ever in return, took some time to answer some questions for me. So how can I not do that? You know what I'm saying?
I think it's fun. I swear that there are more kind people in our industry than I think people realize. Like, the more that I meet people or whatever, it just seems like there are a lot of people like that, and all of us struggle. It's impossible that you didn't.
Yeah.
I don't see how you could have not. It doesn't matter what your background is.
Writing is a lonely job, and it's a job filled with a million no's all the time.
Yeah.
And people are sensitive to that. Like, so if somebody asks me for some help, I should help them, because I know exactly the feeling that they're having right now when they go a month without anybody returning an email. Like, that's a sucky thing. So, you know, I think that connects everybody in it.
Did you have a moment, forget about like a lot of page hits or this one broke or whatever, but just like on a personal level where you're like, oh yeah, like I think I'm starting to get this a little bit. Like, you turned a phrase the right way, or you just like really nailed the story or whatever. Was it really early? Do you feel like it took a long time?
It took several months. I had started, and I was writing for like a little tiny neighborhood newsletter that this woman was printing up in her garage with her husband.
Amazing.
And handing it out. That was the very first place I ever wrote.
Did she pay you?
$15.
Amazing.
The near north.
You know what? I think the first gig that I had was might have been 15 Canadian, so you beat me though. But yeah.
It was the near northwest banner. There's a pizza place like 10 minutes away from here, and they have a kiosk in there with a bunch of little newspapers. So I saw that. I grabbed all of them. Emailed every, like, I did that thing. And she let me write a thing for her, and I flipped that into the next thing. And eventually I landed at the Houston Press.
Yep.
And I was pitching concert coverage and stuff like that. And I pitched a cover story, and I'd never written, like, a big thing before, but they greenlit the cover story, And I started researching that. It was like an 8-week process or 6-week process. And whenever you do a cover story for the press or for really any place, that's when you have interactions with like the editor-in-chief. So she's still there, this woman named Margaret Downing. And she was very, very patient with me and like explaining, this is how a cover story should be written. This is how you like... Because it was an investigative piece. It was about...
Gee, that's a lot early on. Yeah,
it was about people who record movies in the movie theater. Because again, this was 2008. We weren't really doing it on the internet yet.
Yeah.
But they would record them in the movie theater and then like sell them at the flea markets and the beauty shops around town. So I got in contact with a guy who was doing that, and so I pitched her the story. But yeah, so she was telling me like, here's how you get information from the city, or here's how you do an interview with the Motion Picture Association of America. Like, she was showing me all this stuff and showing me how to write it and like explaining what's good, what's bad. And working on that story is when I felt like, I think I can do this. I'll give it a try. And then it was also helpful. Up until then, all the stuff I'd written was like $20 blog posts or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that big cover story, they paid me $2,000 for it, which blew my mind.
I know.
I was still teaching. I was teaching at the time. My teacher paychecks every 2 weeks were like $1,200, $1,100. And I got that one. And I didn't even ask ahead of time what they were paying me.
Yeah.
I just did it.
Yeah.
And that showed up. And I was like, this is incredible. I'll do this more often.
You know? I mean, that's rare for anybody now. Like, it's just, it's hard to pull off. It's got to be a great feeling of accomplishment. You talked about BuzzFeed and Leach and all these people. What about influences on the reading side? I mean, I obviously Simmons has got to be one. Like, it seems like it's in your DNA, and obviously you guys have linked up and work-wise and all that stuff. Who else, like, did you really gravitate toward as you were getting into it?
Simmons was one of the first ones. I was working at before teaching, I was, like, at a construction company.
Yeah.
And they would have these trailers that the home builders would work out of.
Yeah.
And you go in there, and it was a computer. There weren't computers around all the time back then. This was, you know, 2004 or something.
Yeah.
But every once in a while, I would go in there, and one of the builders, he would have a screen up, and I knew if I saw... It was like an orange or yellowish background.
Page two. Hunter S. Thompson, Ralph Wiley.
Yeah. If I saw that, I knew it was Bill.
Yeah.
Bill's stuff, and I would like try to sneak on his computer when he would leave and read it. So yeah, he was definitely one of the first ones. And then once I didn't pay too much attention to. I didn't read a lot in the beginning. It wasn't until I decided I was going to try to write that I started. But like Chuck Klosterman was a big one. And then the further into it I got, the more people I found. It was like, today, even still, Gia Tolentino.
She's great.
From the New Yorker, yeah. She's actually from Houston.
Oh, cool.
Which I didn't know until recently. Doreen St. Felix is also at the New Yorker. She was at MTV. Chris X was like one of the first rap writers who just was, I thought was incredible.
Yeah.
He writes even still today, but he writes in a way that I can never ever write. Just
what does it take to write a great rap story? Is it different than writing a great something else?
It's
story?
All the same.
Yeah.
You gotta figure out how do you connect this guy's story to everybody.
Yeah.
And he was the best at it in my opinion. But like him, John Caramonica, Sean and Chris and all those guys. Yeah, I've never.
And then you ended up working with all of them.
I ended up working with all of them.
Yeah.
It was wild.
I want to ask you also about chronology, because, like, you know, skill goes a long way, obviously, and practice goes a long way and stuff, but circumstances matter. Luck matters for all of it. Doesn't matter what your background is and all that stuff. And I sometimes wonder how I do in 1957 or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, if it's an era in which you can't. Like, your writing style is informal, there's first person in it, and it's, like, super-duper entertaining, but it's not, like, J-School 101 at all. It's
right.
Not, like, before the blog era, before any of that stuff. I don't know. I guess there were people like that. I don't know, but, like, it just seems different. Is it possible to imagine how you'd fare in the landscape in 1985 or whatever? Like, what would that look like? Could you even make a go of something like this?
I doubt it.
Yeah.
I needed the internet to connect myself to all the people. I think that's why back then it was so important that you went to journalism school.
Yeah.
And you made all of those connections. It's way easier to make a friend on the internet than it was to like make a friend through the postal service.
Of course, yeah.
So I needed the internet, if for nothing else, than to wiggle my way into the circle.
Makes sense. I also want to ask you about questions as a framing method, because it's like it pervades your, like Grantland was like that, The Ringer was like that, it's totally, I mean, this is literally a book of questions. Uh-huh. Is that just the most, is that the easiest jumping off point for you? How did you come to that as this device that you use like a lot and it works extremely well? It's just like, yeah, that's exactly how I would, I'm reading, I'm just like, oh, of course it should be a question.
Right. I think it's, for me, the most entertaining.
Yeah.
For myself, mm-hmm. when I'm writing that way. But also it's helpful because if I just sit down and start writing without that question in my head of what I'm trying to answer, then I'll just write 12,000 words and not get anywhere. So with the book, I knew if I just start with a question, I have to answer this. And then it becomes just easier to work within those fences, because then it's like, you know what the question is, and now when I'm writing it and when I'm editing it, I know if this sentence I'm writing doesn't help me answer this question, then it should not be in here and I can take it out. And it just makes everything clearer for me because all my stuff is scattershot.
And I freaking love Arturo Torres. Like I just, yeah, it's he's really good. And what the book, when I picked it up, the first thing that I thought of was the Free Darko guys immediately. Mm-hmm. The illustrations, the style of writing, it just had, I mean, a little different, but just like there were some common themes or anything. Had you read their stuff before? Had you? The idea of the illustration, like, well, in the first one you did yourself, the Bun B one, like, was it just, oh, this is always going to be my path if I'm going to go for big projects, as people like images in that way too? Because, I mean, it just, the writing is incredible, but it's so enhanced by, like, a picture of Bob Cousy from the neck down or whatever.
Yeah, it, for me, it helps pull everything together because everybody doesn't have the same brain that you have.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So when I'm writing a thing, I can see it in my head. It makes sense, but it's very helpful if I can show somebody what I'm picturing. So if I make a statement, like there's a picture that I really like of Scottie Pippen walking away from an explosion. And the reason we have that picture is because I was writing about his dunk over Patrick Ewing.
Yeah.
And it, for me, the more important than anything else is I'm trying to capture some sort of theme or tone in the writing. And that's why I like the art, because the art will... If I can't do it in the writing, then you know that's what I was going for by looking at that picture, and then maybe it'll help pull it all together. So yeah, I try to incorporate as much art in that stuff as possible.
How does that look creatively when you, like, you used to try your own, and then you went to someone, like, how'd you meet up with Arturo? How did you guys figure out, okay, this thing could work? Because, like, there are a lot of good artists in the world, but you could go to them and you could be like, I want this, and maybe they don't get you. Like, how is it that you guys really seem to have connected intellectually?
I met him... Again, through the internet.
Yeah.
He had done a flyer for this rap group, this local rap group, mm-hmm. that I like. And when I saw the flyer, I was like, this is exactly the sort of art I'm looking for. Because I was already working on the rap yearbook. And I knew I needed an artist because I didn't want to do it all myself.
Yeah.
So I found the flyer. I saw him, his work. I got in contact with the group. And then they connected me to their manager. And then she connected me. Or she just gave me his name. And then I, you know, hunted him down from there. And it turned out he was just this Mexican dude from Dallas.
Amazing.
And yeah, it was great. So I contacted him. We talked on the phone once or twice. I explained what I was trying to do. He was into it. At the time, I think he was working like part-time at Urban Outfitters or something like that. And he was excited about trying to do a book. So we just started off. And in the beginning, it was like I was trying very hard to keep him corralled. And like, I need exactly this picture of this. And it was just too much back and forth. And it wasn't working. And I figured out the best way for him to work was to just fucking get out of his way.
Yeah.
So it became a situation where rather than me saying, I need a picture of Scottie Pippen walking away from an explosion, I would just say, I need a picture of Scottie Pippen doing something cool.
Oh, and he would just come up with it.
And then just let him work.
Yeah.
And two or three days later, he would send me a picture, and I'd be like, this is perfect. This is exactly what I need. And every once in a while, he'll miss the mark, or I will not, because I wouldn't have explained exactly the theme I was going for, but you know, 9 times out of 10, he shows up with something I had not even pictured, but that fits it perfect. So that's how we work, and it's almost exclusively through text or email every once in a while. But yeah, I just tell him a feeling I need and or what I'm writing about, and then just let him do what he does.
This is somewhat related, but I have to shout out Aaron Dana, who I don't know if you know his work.
He's great.
Yeah, he's done Grantland and a bunch of other stuff, and there's some similarities there too. And I just, you said different people think differently. I have nothing. I have no artistic talent, nothing. I can't even imagine trying to draw. And the people who can tell stories just by like you know, even the slope of somebody's jaw is just, it's like, it blows me.
He did a thing for me when I was at Grantland, one of my favorite articles. It was about Jean-Claude Van Damme, and he did the art for that one. I was really excited. I didn't even ask permission from Grantland. I just contacted him and was like, hey, can you do this art?
Yeah.
And then I'll try to figure out how to pay you. And
he's blown up.
Yeah, it was wonderful. I was really excited. I have some of his artwork hanging in the room.
That's right awesome.
Here. Yeah, like there's a White Men Can't Jump picture that he drew.
Yeah, I remember that.
And a bunch of like little tiny cards that are just portraits, and then some like I think they're like 7x7s of a bunch of portraits. I bought a bunch of his stuff.
He gave me a Daryl Strawberry T-shirt. It's bright orange.
Yeah. I remember that one. It's the
best. Okay, I want to get into the book, and he starts to talk about like the Pip and Dunk, and the book is just like, it's dunks. There's a lot of freaking dunks.
A lot of dunks in there.
And, like, I mean, we all like dunks or whatever, but it seems like it's part of your DNA, and I love the section about cricket. That's like one of my favorite parts of the book. And the idea, it's funny because I'm much taller than you. But I couldn't dunk other than a volleyball either. I'm 6'4". I just have no ability.
I'm 6'3". So.
You are 6'3", for sure. But, and so I would like almost withdraw myself from thinking about dunks because like, why am I so tall and I can't properly dunk? I don't know. My hands are too small. I don't know. But, also I have no jumping ability. But there was something mythological about cricket, and there's something about the way that you talk about dunks. It's more than like, oh, dunk. Is it just like your earliest memories of basketball are just dunks in your mind, or is it a personal thing that you're like, you wish that you could dunk, or is it just dunks are cool and that's that?
I think it starts with me never having been able to dunk.
Yeah.
And it's like a mythology almost. Mm-hmm. And then you see people do it, or you see them do it in real life, and it's this very incredible thing to me. And then once you get past just that part of it, then there's always like stuff wrapped up in dunks that you can, it's like a release of aggression for a lot of times, especially on that Pip and Dunk.
Yeah.
The part in the book you're talking about is like all about the most disrespectful dunks, which is just a fun thing to get into and study. But yeah, you've got a part of it. I always wanted to do it. I never could. It's like you can play basketball forever and just never touch that part of the game. So it's just a special thing.
Yeah.
And then just disrespectful stuff is always fun and funny, and it all fits together perfectly for me.
I love the way you talk about some of the guys who got disrespected, like the Chris Dudley stuff. Chris Dudley, who's like a super smart guy and like accomplished in many ways and stuff like that, and it was just, that's how we're going to remember Chris Dudley.
Yeah.
And now, and that's like a crossover to what I was going to ask you. I didn't mean to cross over, but I guess we're going there. I love the stuff about players that are known for other stuff or known for negative stuff. It feels like there's a real redemption element to it. Like, there's a whole freaking chapter about poor Nick Anderson, like, which I've never read anything like that before. But then you think about it, you're like, well, yeah. Is that a personal thing for you? Or like, well, you know, I've had redemption too? Or are you just like an empathetic person? Because with that, like, in terms of like poignancy, that might have been it for me. All that stuff, I was like, oh, I love this.
Yeah. I think I do. I'm sort of drawn to those players who end up in those situations, mostly because I could never, I don't know what it feels like to be LeBron James. Like, I've never been the LeBron James of anything at all.
Yeah.
I'm more of like Booby Gibson. Like that guy who might have one or two great moments and the rest of his career is like a punchline, it feels like. So yeah, it's fun to watch those guys or study those guys and try to get a more rounded picture of who they are, or the stuff they've gone through. Like John Starks was one of my favorite players just because of all the stuff he had to get through just to be a Nick. And then now we're going to like remember him for the game 7 when he just fell apart.
He's in a Beastie Boys lyric. That's a big deal.
Yeah. And he's done all of these incredible things, and he's this very just like remarkably tough person, and we don't pay attention to that enough, I feel like. So I wanted to do that with a bunch of other players who, anytime somebody talks about them, it's for a bad reason, but there's like other cool stuff that they did.
The toughness stuff comes up too in the Purge chapter, and you know, you write for Paul Pierce basically, and Paul Pierce has this he's gone now, but he developed this reputation, like there was the wheelchair in LA or whatever, that Paul Pierce was soft. It's like,
yeah, that dude got stabbed 11 times. That doesn't really happen to very many people. And I don't know why we kind of lost, like, obviously he's a great career, he's going to be a Hall of Famer, but, like, for some reason he got this reputation. Maybe it's just because people in L.A. didn't like him because he went from L.A. to Boston, but, like, dude, like, he got stabbed 11 times. What are you going to do with that? I don't know.
You can't do anything more than what he did and stay alive and not be tough.
So there's the dunking, and then there's the who you want to dunk on. And I want to know, like, the end of it, you kind of go into it. I don't even know if I want to spoil it, but let's say that there's a historical figure. You can tell it or not, because it'll be up to you, but there's a historical figure you're like, I want to dunk on this guy. How do you go through the process of thinking about who it is that you want to do? I feel like this is like a, you know, like, who would you want to beat up or whatever? Would you want to beat up Gandhi? Would you want to
Right.
All that stuff. And again, this depends on whether or not you want to get into this guy, but, like, why was it that guy?
When, so the chapter you're talking about, yeah. who, if you could dunk on anyone, who would it be? Originally, it started out as, like, you have to pick an NBA player.
Yeah.
And then that just seemed way less fun when I started writing it. But that was one of the few ones where I just wrote it one time straight through, and you can sort of tell when you're reading it as you get to the end, and I, like, realize the guy that I should have picked or I'm going to.
So that was legit. It wasn't like a writing device. You literally wrote, you're like, oh, what the fuck, this guy, obviously.
I was like,
that's interesting.
Just sitting there writing and coming up with names, and like, it would be cool to dunk on this person, but maybe not for that reason, or this person, but not for that reason. And then, I just ended up with the last guy. And that one wasn't like a prepared thing or whatever. I knew going in I was going to do this just like a one take and see what happens, and it worked out.
Have you ever been dunked on in a game?
Yeah, I have. I was in college the first time it happened. Because I went to San Antonio. I went to high school in San Antonio.
Yeah.
Which is, the part where I was in was almost exclusively Hispanic.
Yeah.
And we don't dunk. It's just not a thing that we do. On my high school team, there were two guys who could dunk, and that was it.
Yeah.
And now, when I coach, like, middle school, we had eighth graders who were dunking.
Gee.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So in high school, it was never a threat that I had to watch out for. But I remember I was in college, it was like my first or second year, and the way the gym was set up, it was four courts, like, next to each other.
Yeah.
And the very first court was like the worst players, and then as you moved up, it was like the next level, and then the last court was the college players.
Yeah.
And you sort of had to work your way up to that court. And I had like a hot streak for 3 months, and I got up to the court with the college players, and I was like super pumped about it. They finally let me play in the game, and I was balling out one game, and I hit like two or three threes in a row.
Nice.
And then I pump faked the guy and drove in and hit a layup over like a big dude, like maybe 6'8", something like that, over his fingers, off the top of the backboard and dropped in. And when it went in, I was like talking back, back down the court. Right, I was really feeling myself, and I guess he was pissed off. And I was jogging, I wasn't paying attention, and I turned around. And when I turned around, he had the ball and was already at the three-point line. And I was like, oh. And he took two steps and then just rose up. And I was like, on that dunk where LeBron dunks on Jason Terry, and he's there, but he's not doing anything.
Yeah.
That was me. I like jumped and sort of turned away from it, and he dunked it on me. And then he's screaming at me, and I was like, well, that's the end of my basketball career against the college guys. Let me move back one court to where they're not dunking on everybody. But yeah, that was the first time I got dunked on, and it happened a couple of maybe two or three more times after that, but I never forgot that one.
Is it better to get out of the way? Is it better to contest? Like, I mean, is it better to love and lost and all that stuff? Because the best, from the aggressor's perspective, the best dunks are when somebody's contesting. You just grab in the guy's face. So if you're the other guy, you just not want to be embarrassed, you're just going to slide out of the way. You're like, no, fuck this. I'm going to go for it.
No, you got to go for it.
Yeah.
I feel like then those are the players I like the most, the ones who, like Brandon.
Yeah, Brandon Knight.
Brandon Knight.
Yeah.
There's no way you're stopping DeAndre Jordan, but he's going to try.
Yeah.
There's no way you're going to stop these guys. I think you got to just get dunked on. If you never get dunked on, then you just weren't trying hard enough.
When I was in high school, I was about 6'4", same height, 6'4", 145, 150.
Tiny guy.
And then in Quebec, you have it's like junior college, basically between high school and university. And so I was the starting center in junior college. By then I was like 6'4", 165.
Uh-huh.
And the other schools had guys, one guy in particular was 6'10",
maybe 280.
Okay.
And he would post me up, and it was a disaster. So I couldn't help but get dunked because I was at the interior. I was like the designated shot blocker and stuff like that. And I remember trying to front him, and that didn't work. And I remember trying to go back of him, and that didn't work. And I'm just like you're getting dunked on transition. I don't know if that's better or worse than just getting bullied, like Shaq versus Dudley. Like, I was Dudley every time.
Oh, that's way worse. Yours is way worse.
Yeah, I was getting thrown to the floor and, like, no concussions, but, like, you know, chest bruises. Mm-hmm. It's not. Hey, you want a great place to buy tickets to concerts or games of your choice? How about SeatGeek? SeatGeek, a longtime sponsor of the Joan and Kerry podcast in its many iterations, and they are fantastic. Data-driven. And really, really cool the way that they go about it. Color-coded map can tell you exactly where you would want to sit, best seats for the best value, at whatever, a baseball game, a hockey game, a basketball game, a concert, an elephant show, whatever it is that you could possibly want. SeatGeek has got you covered. I've used them for all kinds of different events, many baseball games and hockey games and concerts. And they are really, really fantastic, and even better, you can get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase if you have not yet signed up, if you've not yet used SeatGeek. So, so easy. You download the free SeatGeek app. You enter the promo code Jonah today, and you get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. That's it. That's all you got to do. It could not be easier. SeatGeek, fantastic. Love them. Love them for sponsoring the show. $20 off your first purchase by entering the promo code Jonah. And there you go. Thank you to SeatGeek for sponsoring the podcast. I want to ask you also about names. Because I feel the same way. You brought up Fenice Dembo, which, like, that's already my favorite thing. And Burkowski and all that stuff. And there's a chapter about what if you switch people's names and all that stuff. It applies for basketball. Do you think it applies for life the same way? Like, if you're a lawyer like Bob Justice, then, like, you're destined to be the best
you're
lawyer.
You're Bob Justice. You're running the law game. Absolutely. Yeah, I think names have a big part of it. What if you were Jacob Carey? You're not, like, a nationally known baseball writer if you're Jacob Carey. Actually, maybe.
I want to change my name.
I think Carey is like the strong part of your name.
Interesting. It's a fake name. It's one of those like came to the border and you have to be. We actually had a choice of in Canada, the family was given Carey or we could have been Kennedys. That was the other choice.
Kennedy.
I could have been a Kennedy.
That would have been dope.
I know.
It would have been good.
Jonah Kennedy?
Both of those names are winners though. Carey and Kennedy, you're good. Yeah, if you've got a sucky name,
yeah,
you're in for a rough ride. There was a girl at my second youngest sister's school.
Yeah.
Her last name was Buttmaster.
Come on.
Buttmaster.
What?
I will never forget it.
With two T's?
With two T's. Buttmaster. It was like Natalie Buttmaster or something like
but
that.
But what could the first name be that could make it better?
There was no way to make that better. And plus, she was like one of the two white kids in the school or in the grade level. Oh, she just got it bad.
Yeah. It doesn't matter if she's like a model. Like, it makes no difference.
No, you got to change your last name. You gotta go Buckmaster.
Buckmaster's amazing.
Buckmaster's strong.
So if you were not happy with your name at whatever age, you would have just changed it?
No, I didn't know you could.
Well, I guess not. I literally, when I started high school, there was a lot of the same kids I went to elementary school with, but I didn't like Jonah at all because nobody was named. Now there's a bunch of six-year-olds named that, but then there was nobody. So my middle name is Matthew, and I'm like, Matt, that's fine. That's cool. Fine. And I tried that for like a week, and my elementary school friends are like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah,
the teacher's not going to call you that.
I'm Matt now.
No 12-year-old Jonah, you're still going to lose it. That's not happening. Let's get into some of the players in the book, and especially Reggie. First of all, how did you go about just asking Reggie to write the intro? Because that had to be amazing for you.
It was very amazing.
Yeah.
That I asked Kristen Ledlow,
yep.
Who she's a host of Inside the NBA.
Yep.
I mean, Inside Stuff. On
formerly Ahmad Rashad
on NBA TV, yeah, which I watched as a kid with Ahmad.
Like, I was a little older than you, but yeah,
my main man,
yeah.
Ahmad. But I don't know how we became friends on Twitter, but we became friends on Twitter and we're following each other. So I knew she was connected to everybody. So let me ask Kristen if she can make this happen. I sent her one email.
Yeah,
hey, this is what I was hoping for, and she just replied back like, "I got it," or something like that. Something real short. I got you. And then that was it. And then like 2 days later, I was on the phone with Reggie. His handler or manager got in contact with me, and she set up a phone call, and we did it. And he was super into it. And I think maybe part of it was because he knew already how much I liked him. Because when I was at Grantland, I wrote this thing. It was like on the 20th anniversary of his 8 points and 9 seconds shot. So, and he saw that article because he tweeted it out or something crazy like that. But yeah, that's how it happened. It was all Kristen. She just you know, pulls some strings or does what she does, and there you go.
It's a, that stuff has been happening to you a lot lately, and it's just, I can't even imagine the feeling when you're just affirmed by, like, oh, like, here's this guy that I've, or gal that I've rooted for my whole life. It's like, oh yeah, totally Reggie Miller wrote the intro to my book. Like, totally Superman came and did, like, it's just, it seems inconceivable. And I feel like there are a lot of awesome parts of this job. Honestly, connecting with readers is probably the best one. But there's a little something to, like, oh yeah, totally, like, who was it Grandmaster Flash on Twitter?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no, no, you talk about that.
With the tweet. The
Sugar, yeah, it was from the Sugar Hill Gang.
Sugar Hill Gang.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Like, shit. Like, that's... I don't even... How do you process that?
Yeah, that was cool to see the book there. I think my favorite one from the Rap Yearbook was when it was on Puff Daddy's Instagram.
Oh, my God.
And it was, like, a shot of his... Like, a, I don't know, an entertainment center or something, and the book was sitting right there. It was, like, one of two things on the shelf. And it was a close-up of it. Maybe he read this chapter. I read or reread it real quick to see if I wrote anything bad about him. But yeah, those sorts of things, when they happen, it's very cool. It's also very weird because it's happened a bunch by this point.
Yeah.
Even just last night, I was, you know, doing some work, and then my phone started going crazy, and it turned out that they were talking about the book during the Spurs Rockets game.
Yeah, I saw that.
And it was like, what the fuck? Why? Like,
Kevin Harlan says you have two kids.
Yeah, yeah. He called. He either said one of them's ugly, or he forgot about one of them. Either way, he's telling the truth because he's like Kevin Harlan. One of my kids is just ugly now. But yeah, stuff like that happens, and after a while, you would think it would become normal, or you wouldn't freak out about it. But I think, as you mentioned before, just because I didn't get into writing it through any sort of traditional way, I felt back then, I still feel today, like an imposter of sorts. Like, I don't belong here, so any of this stuff that happens, it's always surprising. Like, maybe everybody else can look at me and say, like, oh, that's a writer or an author or whatever, but... It's still weird for me to say it myself, even after all this time. So, yeah, when something like that happens, when Reggie's like, yeah, sure, I'll write the foreword for it, it's just, you freak out, man.
I can only speak for myself and the people I've talked to, but even if you come to it from a more traditional background, even if you have some of the advantages that whatever, like, I think a lot of us feel like imposters every day about something or other.
That's good. I'm glad to hear that.
No, but it's like a universal thing, and I think that you just realize that this is getting off topic a little bit, but you just realize that more and more in life, it's like it doesn't matter what status this person has or how good they are. Like, we're all kind of faking it. We're trying,
yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know how to get there. I have no idea. I don't know what I'm going to do next. I don't know anything. Like, it's
right.
It all seems... Anyway. I want to ask you about MJ, too, and maybe it's MJ as a way into other stuff, so... With MJ, I feel like the moment, well, there were a lot of moments with him, but it was probably the Celtics game in 86. Like, Bird declares that he's God, disguised as Michael Jordan. He went for 63 at the Garden, which was preposterous. That team could really play defense, and he just did anything they wanted to do. You bring that, and so it's MJ, that's fine. He's the greatest player of all time, but you bring that forward now. How do you know? Like, we have Giannis, and we have Towns, and we have Porzingis. These guys might be, like, mega stars, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like it's one flashpoint moment, like, Kawhi dunked on someone, you're like, oh yeah, now Kawhi is obviously part of the Illuminati? Or is it like a gradual process where you're like, all right, I could see him getting better, I could sort of see it coming?
It's a gradual thing.
Yeah.
It's the accumulation of moments.
Yeah.
If you get enough of these very special moments, then you can be included in that class. Because everybody can have one or two. You can get a Deion Waiters. Three against the Warriors to win the game,
yeah.
And you pose, and it's great. You need like 20 of those,
yeah,
to be in that top level class, where we can have a 30 for 30 about one of them, and be able to talk about five other ones that maybe we should have had it on.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's an accumulation thing.
I want to ask you about Duncan, because, you know, MJ, Iverson, there are these guys that are these iconic players, and they're just, like, so mesmerizing. Like, I loved Iverson. And I think the only time I ever felt cool in my entire life was I used to play pickup basketball at USC when I lived in L.A. So I was, like, 24, so I was, you know, whatever. Kids are a little younger than me. And I was the only white guy pretty much every time, and I was by far the worst player. But I that's what you said about getting into the A game and being the worst player. It's great, because if you do well, you're like, oh, I showed up. It's great.
Yeah.
And I was never a sneaker guy. Like, I never went for the newest or whatever, but the new Iversons came out.
The Questions?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I go on the court.
Number one basketball shoe of all time for me.
I agree. They're awesome.
But the red ones. I like the red. You know, they got the red and the blue.
Yeah.
Give me the red ones.
I think I went all white. And I like that's fair. They looked really good. I didn't have any pattern, but I just liked them. And I walked onto the court, and the guy who, like, I got to know him a little bit, and he was probably one of the best players. He's like 6'6", he could shoot, he could do whatever he wanted. He looks at me and goes, "Damn, the new iPhones!" I'm like, yes! Yes!
Yeah. That's the power Iverson had.
It's pretty amazing that way. But Duncan doesn't have that, and he never had that. And obviously, your affinity for Duncan goes hand in hand with your affinity for the Spurs. But if you're sort of looking outside yourself and saying, wow, I loved MJ, I love these guys who are just these iconic guys with these big moments or whatever, how does one learn to love, the big fundamental? A guy like that who just, like, does it every day, especially you love dunks, you love this, you love flash. Here comes this guy who, very skilled, but he did it with consistency.
Right. When something like that happens, I think you can fall in love with a player from far away when they have those big moments, like Iverson stepping over Lou or crossing over Jordan, yeah, or any of the times Reggie went nuts in the Garden. With Timmy being in San Antonio, the reason he became so beloved was, for me, San Antonio has always had this inferiority complex. It still has it today. It's never been a cool place. It's never been like, we have great schools, or we don't have anything, really. Like, nobody in New York or LA is like, I can't wait to make it to San Antonio one day. Nobody says that shit. So you're always feeling that. We're not even the coolest in Texas. Like, we're miles and miles behind Houston and Austin.
Yeah.
Probably behind Dallas,
really. Yeah.
So that's always there, and that's always in your head, and we're, you know, whatever, you're that team, or that just that place. And then all of a sudden, you've got this guy who is the best player in the world at points. Like, the number one player on the planet belongs to you, and you have a guy that everybody's afraid of, and a guy that is going to deliver championships to you, and you're going to get to feel like a champion for the first time ever. You're the number one. Like, there's your name and number one, and, like, that's a very powerful feeling. So you've got that, first of all, but then also, he was very much like, he fit perfectly in Hispanic culture. You just do your work and you don't say anything. And he fit all of the stuff your parents were telling you to do,
yeah,
and to be like. He was that all of the time. And it was like, it just all matched up exactly right. And that's why everybody fell in love with him. And he, you know, when you can put that feeling, you're a champion, or you're number one in somebody's chest, like, you become a god, basically. Right? People ask me all the time, well, what's it like being a Spurs fan living in Houston? I mean, it's fucking excellent because we've won so many times. Like, it feels great now. It's not like before. So that's how he became, like, this, you know, unbeatable figure in San Antonio. Even with, like, somebody like Manu, who is coming from the other way, but he looks like us, and he's very fiery, and he's very cool. But he was never able to get to that level that Duncan did, as far as just belovedness, because Duncan was that dude.
Yeah. And I'm equally interested in the way that you grow to hate a player, because I find that great. I guess it could just be like an arch rival of the Spurs or whatever, but, like, you lay it on Karl Malone pretty hard.
Yeah, because they used to torment the Spurs.
That's it? That's it?
That's all it was. The Jazz were always beating up on the Spurs, and then you had a couple of plays where he took, like, some cheap shots at he knocked David Robinson out one game,
yeah,
with a dirty elbow, just straight up, like, that was your guy, and you saw him get knocked out. And how do you not hate that? And then what's great is you start to hate this guy, and then you get to watch him fall on his face over and over again against the Bulls, or even when he joined the Lakers and that fell apart. It was great. But yeah, to sort of sports hate somebody, for me, a lot of times it's regional.
Yeah.
It's happening again with Harden, but there are, like, some things that you need to have in place. Number one, they need to be a very good player. It's,
yeah,
not fun to hate somebody who's not good. Part of the reason that rooting against James Harden is fun for me is because he can absolutely just slit your throat. That's why the series against the Spurs and Rockets last year was so much fun, or last postseason, because the Rockets should have beat the Spurs, and Harden just disappeared totally, you know, so great. But that's not fun if there's not that threat there.
You know,
there's got to be the prospect of you losing. So you have to have that. You also have, it helps if they're on a rival team. San Antonio has a rivalry with Houston and with Dallas, so it's like, we don't like Dirk, we don't like Harden, we're going to battle against these guys. And then also there are other guys like Rick Fox or who you just don't like the way that they look and the way that they talk and the way that they behave, and it's like that's part of it too.
He's too good looking.
He's very good looking. It's a problem. He's very successful.
Yeah.
Great jawline, great teeth. he's very talented. And he's a good actor.
Yeah.
He's like good at everything, it turns out.
Yeah.
So how can I root for him, because I'm the opposite of all of those things.
You have good teeth.
They're okay. They're not great.
They're solid teeth.
They're like a 7, maybe 6. He's a 10. But then you've got that. And then also if you've just got a team who's just beating the Spurs all the time, like with the Lakers in the early 2000s. And it was like I watched them in the Spurs season so many times. And you just start to root against them. And then in those instances, there's always a level of respect with those guys. Of course, you respect Harden and Kobe.
Yeah.
That has to be there for you to hate them as well. I know they're coming. I wrote about it in the book. One of my favorite basketball memories was being terrified that Kobe was coming to San Antonio. They played against the Rockets one game, and Shane Battier beat him up really well. And everybody was talking about how Shane Battier guarded Kobe Bryant for like two days straight. And in my head, I was like, why, y'all, you're killing me. Because I knew he was coming for blood.
55 points, next
yeah,
year, for
I,
sure.
He's I know he hears all this, and he's going to come out and just put us in the dirt. You need those parts to sports hate somebody.
Two segues. I was going to go to Kobe. One other one. I wrote about a baseball player one time, and it wasn't like ad hominem attacks or whatever, but, you know, I did whatever I did, and I met the person afterwards. And they just busted my balls and gave me some grief, and it was fine. Like, it ended up being pleasant. How do you think it would go if you met Malone, or maybe even more, how do you think it would go if you met J. Cole?
I'm sure they'd have no clue who I am or...
Oh, come on, man.
Any of the stuff.
Sugar Hill Gang, Reggie Miller, all these people know you. I don't know about that.
If I would be very intimidated to meet Karl Malone.
He's a big dude.
He's a big, scary guy. He knocked out David Robinson.
You could take J. Cole.
I don't think so. J. Cole's tall. He's got reach. If we got in a fist fight, I think he's putting me down.
You got leverage. Tall's overrated.
The only thing that I have in my favor is that I don't mind cheating. So I'll hit you in the head with a bottle if it comes to that. But if I met those guys, I'm sure we would have a conversation about whatever. But why would they?
You never say anything cruel or anything.
No. Like I just like I don't with the J. Cole thing. I don't like his music, and that's what it is.
Yeah.
And like that. Why do I have to like somebody's music just because you're making music? Basically, there are a bunch of people who don't like my writing, and that's just what it is.
Yeah.
I don't think it would be anything weird. I think it would be more funny to meet these guys and like take a picture or whatever.
So with Kobe, Kobe's always the ultimate competitor, and he's got the underbite and this, that, and Kobe, fierce Kobe, and alpha dog Kobe or whatever, and you just declare that Kobe's a dork. And that's the best disarming, like there's literally no greater burn than that. Aside from the fact that, again, Kobe's a rival, and so you're going to take forever... Yeah. Shots, I guess. What is it that makes him that as opposed to like I feel like there's a lot of ways you can criticize Kobe. Some of them are actually pretty harsh, but this was just like, oh, like that was the perfect burn. Like, how'd you come to that one?
Calling him a dork?
Yeah,
because he's a dork.
But why? How?
You call him a dork? Well, you just look at some of the stuff that he's done. Kobe, to me, has that in common with Chris Webber, where they sort of wanted this street cred. That they weren't quite able
to. They were rich
to,
kids, though, both of them.
That they weren't able to really get.
Yeah.
And Chris Webber, less so. He was a cool person.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, he was like a very handsome guy, and he was, all of his stuff, for the most part, felt natural. But with Kobe, he just tried too many different ways to be cool, and like he had the rap thing, and it was really bad. And you mentioned the underbite thing that he started doing, like his angry face, that just out of nowhere, I'm going to start doing this because he saw somebody else do it. He started giving himself nicknames, and it was just like it was just a bunch of dork moves in a row that made him dorky, but also terrifying. Like there's just no getting around that he was a terrifying basketball player, but I feel like there's also not getting around that. He called himself Vino because he was getting better with age. And then it turned out...
I had forgotten about that.
Yeah. And then he had I remember he had a guy who was talking about how Kobe was going to be the next Nas of rap or some bullshit like that. Like, come on, man. Nobody was saying that.
Hey, you know what? Season-long fantasy football, pain in the ass. I just lost on a ridiculous
not since this Titans-Colts game as I'm recording this, and I'm annoyed about it, but you know what? FanDuel laughs all that because it's much, much better. New contest starting every week. You don't have to worry about your garbage team and your terrible quarterback and all these things that I don't want to talk about. And FanDuel, they're great. It's fantasy football for everyday fans. You got new contests, like I said, starting every week. No busted seasons. So you can get contests starting at $1. That's all you got to do to get in on the action. A lot of fun. You pick a contest, you choose your team, and you watch your score real time, really, really easy. More than 2.5 million players have won a cash prize playing fantasy sports on FanDuel. So you can sign up today very easily. Go to FanDuel.com, F-A-N-D-U-E-L.com. Click the Join Now button and use the promo code Jonah. New users get free entry to the NFL Sunday Million, which is more than $1 million in cash prizes. When you make your first deposit on FanDuel, again, visit FanDuel.com and sign up with the promo code Jonah.
Yeah, it's, Illmatic is the best album of all time, and whatever Kobe does is obviously number two. But there's no question.
It's a close.
It's a close second. So I, like you, cannot get enough White Man Can't Jump. I would probably guess I've seen it 80 or 90 times. Like, it's just, it's weird because, like, if somebody asks you what's your favorite movie of all time, you're supposed to be like, oh, The Godfather or whatever. I'm like,
nah.
I don't know if it's White Man Can't Jump, but it's really high up there. It's a perfect movie.
It's a perfect sports movie. It's a perfect movie about race. It's yeah, it's up there. For me, it's probably second or third favorite movie of all time. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And well, I'm going to have a question in a second, but one thing that resonates to me the most, and, like, obviously the scenes with the two of them are some of the best, but when Rosie Perez asks for the water, or says, but of course, and, like, I learned so much about myself. I still can't help it to this day that I'm just like, I have to fix this problem.
Mm-hmm.
And is it because I have male genitalia that I'm just like, I have to fix this? Like, why? Who decided that? Like, I literally can't be just empathetic. Oh, tell me more about your water. Let me fix. Like, I don't know. There's something about that that's totally right. And I still don't know to this day, why is it? Is it just dudes? Is it certain kinds of dudes? Why do we think that we have to try to actually come up with a solution to a problem? Mm-hmm. And I don't know. Anyway, so the question that I have is, there's a two different dynamic duo chapters. Well, there's a fictional character chapter, and then there's a dynamic duo NBA chapter.
Uh-huh.
So I want to merge them. Dean and Hoyle.
Uh-huh.
And let's assume that they have the abilities given to them in the movie. It's not exactly clear how tall they are. Let's assume that they're NBA level tall. Let's assume that one is 6'8 and one is 6'6 or whatever. Look, they're pretty big guys.
In the movie, they're small. They're like 6'1.
Right. Let's say that they're a little bit bigger and they can do everything else. And they're going up and they're like the street the legends and they beat the King and the Duck and they're that good.
Okay.
And they go up against one of the best duos. I'm not going to say whether it is the best or not. They're going up against Kemp and Peyton.
Mm-hmm.
Are they getting any points?
I think they get a few points.
Yeah?
I think a couple. If they get the ball first.
Yeah.
Billy's getting some buckets.
You think so?
Against Peyton, yeah. Because...
I guess if he's 6'6". Yeah. So let's assume that they're roughly... Let's assume that Sidney's about 6'9". He's not far from Kemp, and let's assume that Peyton and Hoyle are about the same height.
They're the same height. Yeah. Billy was too clever of a player to not be able to score. You remember the one shot? It's like a two-handed backwards falling away from the rim off the backboard shot. Like, he's going to do a couple of those on you. He never missed a shot in the movie.
Is that true?
Not once, I don't think. If he shoots it, it's going in.
Yeah, Sidney definitely missed. Well, obviously in the showdown, but even in the games too.
Yeah, he missed on purpose also.
Yeah, well, that's right.
But yeah, they get a few. If they played a 15, they get 4 points until the Sonics get the ball, and then it's a wrap.
It's an interesting concept to me, the two-handed shot, because, like, I feel like players like that can succeed for short periods in pickup. Like, when I shoot a hook shot.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's done that since, like, Kareem or George Mikan or whatever. And, like, I do it on some guy. They go, what are you doing? And then there's something. Did you have something like that? Like an old man move or something where it's, like, aside from threes and aside from just the conventional stuff, where you had one go-to and people were just like, I don't know what the fuck to do with it. And you would get a couple every game off of that.
I did when I got older. I was, let's say, up through, like, 30 or so, I was very, because I'm small, very fast.
Yeah.
So I could get to the rim on some, like, Tony Parker.
Yeah.
And so I had that. And then when I got older and I started slowing down, I came up with this, it's not quite a hook shot, but it's something similar to a hook shot. And I would go in the post, which was always ridiculous, right? So down by the box, that's by the free throw line,
mm-hmm.
I would go right there. And I would call for the ball. Don't throw it up, though. Give it to me.
Literally, back at the guy, calling for it, calling in a game of 5-on-5. You might be the shortest guy on the court.
I'm always the shortest guy on the court, or I'm close to. But that means that the shortest guy on the other team is guarding me. So it's like 5'7 versus 5'10 in the paint. And I call for the ball down low. Don't throw it. I'll tell him, don't throw it high. Like, bounce basically back. Roll it to me so that he can't get it. And then I would, like, just straight up two dribbles, shake to the left, come to the right to put my shoulder into his chest.
Yeah.
And then it was like a push shot, basically, that went 15 feet up in the air. And I practiced it, because I was teaching still, I practiced it in the gym several hours over the course of like a couple of weeks, just every single day. And so I got pretty good at it. And I started doing that, and then it was like, this was a thing I could do. And we were playing, by this point, we were playing against high school kids, so they're all made of rubber and jumping through the ceiling. And for some reason, they would panic when I would go down there because they knew it was coming. And then they would all run at me, and I would just throw it back out. But that was my one secret move that I had.
I like that. Well, and you talk a lot about little guys who do stuff around the rim, too. Like, Sherman Douglas stood out to me. Like, he had floaters. All kinds of stuff. But Parker, man, like, I didn't know the numbers. By the way, the book, even though it's wildly entertaining, like, it's just the right amount of numbers. Mm-hmm. It, and I'm like, numbers are a lot of what I do, but it hits it. And with Parker, like, you're telling stories, but you're also like, yeah, the guy shot, I don't even remember what the number was, but some insane number in the lane. He's 6'1".
Mm-hmm. Led the league and
led the league. I mean, are we missing out on how good Parker was / is?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah?
We're talking about one of the greatest point guards of all time, which gets washed away because of the greatness of Tim or how good Manu was.
But or even Kawhi now. Like, it's just, that's Parker. He's fine.
Yeah. You just assume he'll get the job done. You don't pay too much attention to him. But, yeah, he was a devastating scorer at the rim. And once he figured out how to shoot a jump shot, the Spurs, that's when they really were, like, very, very good.
Yeah.
And
he never really learned how to shoot threes. That was the thing. It wasn't that he would outfake you on the three and then get to the lane. He could outfake you from 17 and get to the lane. But, like, at the beginning, he just had that. Yeah. And it worked anyway.
Yeah, that's why I mentioned it in the book when we were talking about getting to the rim, because Steph is fantastic at getting to the rim, too. But he has that threat of the three where you have to run him off the line.
Literally the best shooter of all time.
And Parker never had that, and he was still able to get there more often than Curry is. Tony Parker is great. I don't think you can put him like top 10 point guard of all time.
You think
But I think maybe you can get him around 13.
13?
Somewhere around there.
I have to think about that a little bit. I love also the chapter about memory heroes, which is really cool. How did you come to that idea, and who was your memory hero?
I came to the idea because I wanted to write about players who otherwise wouldn't get to appear in a basketball
book. Yeah.
Right? So how do you do that? I wanted to write about Vinny Del Negro, who was my guy when I was younger.
Yeah.
He played for the Spurs for a little tiny bit. And I thought he was just great because I thought he was Mexican. We all thought he was Mexican. We just convinced ourselves that he was that. So he was, in our heads, the best player in the league for sure. And so I wanted to write about him. And then I was just, thinking on the topic. And I figured surely everybody else has a player like this who grew up watching basketball. So let me ask a few other people who theirs were and if they want to do a thing for the book, and that's how we got there.
Danny Ainge, only because he started, that was my guy.
That's a great one.
I was never that great, but I would not shut up, and I was so skinny and whatever, and I had long hair, so I wore like a bandana. The worst, like, literally the most hateable player of all time, but, like, mostly around 16. But yeah, Danny Ainge, because I'm like, nobody liked Danny Ainge, perfect.
Nobody, and I will always remember the play when he threw that basketball in Mario Elie's face.
He bit Trey Rollins!
He bit his finger, like, almost off. He was a
punk!
A wild man.
Yeah.
Yeah, he should have got beaten up several times.
He should have. So should I. There was one game in high school when I went for, like, 25, and I was pointing in the stands like I was going off, I did that a lot, and then the guy came down and confronted me after the game. I was like, maybe I should stop pointing. I want to ask you also about the code, the New York Times bestseller code. So there's two, this is going to be two questions.
Okay.
One I want to ask you about is what it felt like when you found out that you had a New York Times bestseller. And the other is, you know how to become a New York Times bestseller. Like, it's aside from, write a good book, there's actually a mathematical formula to it. So let's start with the visceral part. It's just like, oh shit, this happened. Like, what did that feel like?
That felt like I was in LA when it happened because I was out pushing the book and I had a book signing out there. And I was at the Grantland office and we were waiting to find out. Because what ended up happening was the book took off and nobody was expecting it to. We're talking about the Rap Here book.
It started
selling like crazy. And the publishers were not prepared for it. So we sold, I think, maybe like 8,500 copies that first week. Something like that. Which they were expecting 1,000 copies. We did 8,500. And they just didn't have enough to ship to everybody. So you only get credit for books if somebody buys them in a store, or if you sell them online, you only get credit once they ship.
Mm.
So we had sold several thousand through Amazon, like 7 of the 8,500 or something, through Amazon, but they only had shipped maybe 4,000 or 5,000 copies. So we didn't get credit for all of them. So it became a thing like we're probably not going to make the list, but it was going to be because of this stupid reason.
Yeah.
So I was already mad, and the publishers were like trying to apologize and. But it
you can't fix that last minute.
No, you can't fix it. But again, it wasn't their fault. Yeah. It just all happened out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. But they were still like, you know, sorry about this, whatever. And then I got the phone call from my editor, Samantha, and I was in the office at Grantland, and I knew it was either going to be very good news or very bad news.
Yeah.
And when I answered, she was like, can I speak with the New York Times best-selling author, Chase Brown?
Oh!
And like a very smooth move like that, right? And so I like made this very loud grunting noise, and I did like, when Michael Jordan hit the shot over Craig Elo and he started did the pump, like I did the fist pump like that, and I was like, yes. Because I knew already, I've been thinking about it all the time. Like I knew once that happened, for the rest of my life, they're going to have to say that before.
Yes!
It's like a big thing.
It's the best.
Right? And I was very, very excited and overwhelmed, and like I called my wife and I called Arturo and told him.
Yeah.
And it was a cool feeling. I told everybody in the office and we were just sort of celebrating, and there you go. As far as the code to get on the list, like
pre-orders,
that's still there's no way to know, because even with the Rap Yearbook, for example, we got credit for I think like 5,500 books,
okay,
and there were books ahead of us that sold less, that sold like 3,000 copies, that were two or three spots higher than us. So the way it was explained to me is you have to sell, you know, at least 7,000 books that first week,
mm-hmm.
but it also has to be. You can't just sell them all from Amazon. It's got to be spread out, and there's got to be like some press around the book. There's what I don't know exactly what the New York Times formula is, but really all you can do is try to sell a bunch of books and make as much noise as you can and cross your fingers and hope. And that's all there is to it. I wish it was just a straight up numbers thing, but it's not. It's more complicated than that.
Well, and on obviously your social media is awesome, but you do self promotion and it's charming, which is fucking hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
And is it just like I'm going to be myself and I'm going to be happy and I'm going to do fist pumps and we'll see if people like it or not? Or was there any strategy behind it? Because like there are a million things you do with social media in addition to that, but like fundamentally we're all on our own island. You're employed by the Ringer. We're all employed, but like it's kind of us. We're out there and we're doing mm-hmm. whatever. So did you just at some point make a concerted decision just like, all right, like, I'm going to go with this and I'm going to try to have fun with it, or because it's just hard to do that without being distasteful. Maybe it's just in our heads it feels that way, but it feels that way to me.
No, it's definitely hard to do that.
Yeah.
Sometimes I see other people doing it, I'm like, ew, this is stupid, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
And I do feel like that at times about myself, but I just try to be, like, at least as honest as possible, or it's very helpful to tell people what numbers are. They really like that. And most publishers won't let you do that. They didn't let me do that with the Rap Year book.
Yeah.
But I was asking for permission to do it this time because it just makes everything a little bit easier. Like if I tell you right now, you know, get down and do push-ups, and then you ask me how many, and I just say a lot.
Yeah.
That doesn't...
What's a lot?
What's a lot?
Yeah.
But if I tell you 20, then you can, like, push yourself to get to 20 even when you feel like stopping. So it was the same thing with the book stuff. As far as why it works, I think maybe because it's such a small portion of the time is devoted to that, because I haven't done this push since like the last book came out 2 years ago, and in between then we've done a whole bunch of other
shit.
You just, all of that time is built up building equity basically with these people, because we're on Twitter together and we're making jokes and like we're feeling friendly, and I'm answering emails and we're talking, and it's like we're buddies now. So of course, if I have a book coming out and you're my buddy, you're going to go buy the book. Like, if you had a book, I would go, oh, Jonah's got a book, let me go buy a few copies.
You do that all the time. You did it with Abrams. I can't even name the number of people,
That's my guy, let me support him. So if you're on Twitter enough and you've got enough people who feel like you're their guy, then yeah, we're sort of in it together is the thing.
Yeah, it really does feel like the you're their guy thing, and the army that has been built is pretty amazing. I love some of the stories. I love the stuff about they feel inspired and so they do X or whatever. Is there one that stands out to you like, oh yeah, you know, they shot their shot or they did whatever it is, right. and you're just like, oh shit, like of all the things, wow, that guy, that gal, that one thing.
No, you know, I try to sort of think through that every once in a while, but there are just so many of them that come in.
Yeah.
That I think more than anything, I just like that we have that sort of reputation where we can all sort of celebrate together.
Yeah.
So if somebody's gets engaged and they take a picture and they send it to me, that's cool that they're letting me be a part.
So of that. Cool.
Or if they like get into graduate school and that if they send me a picture, then that means when they got into graduate school, at some point along the way, they were like, oh, I'm going to send this to Shay. And that's very meaningful to me that they would let me be a part of that. And I'm going to take credit for them getting into school.
Sure.
Like, I'm going to take all the credit that they want to give me very playfully, but just that they would let me be a part of that thing, like we're going to celebrate some cool stuff together, it means a whole bunch to me. So yeah, if it's like I got a job or I got engaged or I got into graduate school, or even if I just apply for a thing and fingers crossed, like, you know, we're in it together.
Cool. Amazing. I got a few more. For a long time, you didn't get too political, and you even called out I'm trying to remember the exact moment, but you basically said, okay, like, enough is enough, and you went for it. What was the inflection point for you that you said, okay, whether it's on social or in writing or whatever, this is what I'm going to start to do a little bit more?
It was when all of the Trump stuff was happening, because he
before
just...
Before he got into office, when he was campaigning?
When he was campaigning.
Yeah.
And it was like, all the stuff he was saying and the stuff he was doing was just too much.
Yeah.
And it was like, it felt like, okay, this is a situation where you have to decide right now, what are you going to be a person who's going to say something, or are you going to be a person who doesn't say something? And in those sorts of situations, I want to at least always be the person who's going to say something. Let me say something.
Yeah.
Because whatever I did, you just feel compelled to do that. And all of a sudden, this guy is like attacking people and making fun of handicapped people and different minorities. And it was like, what is going on? Why are people supporting this guy that's doing these things? Why do you not see how bad this is?
Yeah.
Yeah, I should be speaking up on that. Especially being a Mexican dude with, like, a tiny bit of platform. How can I not? You know what I'm saying? How can I not speak up for anybody, for these other people who don't have this thing? I'm getting emails from other people, and they're like, I don't know what to do. This is terrible. What do I say? You know?
Like, yeah.
You got to say something. Just say something.
Yeah, and I mean, you built that equity with the army or whatever, but you're never going to have 100% hit rate on politics, no matter what. So, I mean, how did you deal with that blowback? I mean, were you just like, well, we disagree, or you're just like, okay, like, I'm sorry, we don't get along, and I guess you're not part of the army anymore. How does that go?
Mostly it's just like...
Yeah.
Like, if you can see...
Well, and you block people, and you have the whole... It's funny when you do it, yeah.
Yeah. That's like... I mean, I do that every once in a while, the blocking thing. Mostly, I just do it in private. It's like, okay. But, yeah, if you can see all of the stuff that he's doing and still find a way to be like, well, I'm still supporting this guy, then it's just like, that's just what it is. There's no gray area. You're either in or against. And so, as far as blowback, that's just what it is. Like, if you make a statement like Donald Trump and anyone who stands with him, the people who stand with him are going to say something, and you have to, like, you just have to accept that, and it's whatever. But I want to be very on the record that this is how I feel, so if you're around me, you can expect that.
Well, and it's not a disagreement about marginal tax rates or what are we going to do about tort reform. Or whatever. It's a different kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, you've lived in Texas for a long time. Politically, there's some interesting stuff going on regardless.
They're all around my house.
Yeah. Speaking of all around your house, so I came over here in a cab, and
that was a smooth segue right there.
Thank you. Speaking of, I'm trying. The cabbie pointed out, hey, you know, like, this neighborhood was in the floodplain, you don't see it as much now. I'm guessing, but like, there are couches on the curb, there's branches or whatever, and it's just a reminder. And I meant to ask you about Harvey, and I didn't know I was going to get into it, But I think the easiest question you told me off before we started talking was everyone got it except you came out like this close.
Yeah.
And you wrote about it, and it was great. It was one of my favorite Shea pieces of all time. Very different kind of Shea piece. How do you go about writing something that's so literally close to you?
You just do it.
Yeah.
I think the thing that I'm trying to do anytime I'm writing something is I want to be as honest as possible.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's just what works
yeah.
for me. And it does make you vulnerable, and you do like sort of open yourself up a bit, which is always scary. But that's just the way you have to approach that situation. And yeah, like you can look out the window here and see there's still trash across the street. They just came last week. All of these piles were like several feet high with when you tear the house out and all the drywall and insulation. Yeah. It was like that all the way around through here. They just came and picked that up this past week. There's still some stuff out there. So yeah, it's like a very sensitive issue to have to deal with. But like you mentioned, in our neighborhood, it all got flooded except there were four or five houses that didn't. And we were in that group, and it was like, that was a weird dynamic to drive through that and get to our house, which is fine, but you've got these people who, their lives are just a wreck. Yeah, of course you feel guilty, and you don't know how to handle it. All you can do is try to help out in every way that you can and be as sensitive as possible to the situation. And like, we might deliver some sandwiches or Gatorades to people who are doing the work, or like, there's a message board right now set up, and somebody might say, I need somebody to watch my kids for 2 hours while we do a thing. Like, you just try to be involved in all of that stuff. But like, that's really all you can do. Just be as sensitive as possible to the situation and help out where you can. And like, and that's it. And you don't get to feel any sort of way above what somebody else is feeling who had to actually go through it. Like, you're always going to be in second place there.
And it's because, I mean, you have been able to take your platform and dip into philanthropy more and more, and like, you know, raising several thousand dollars in an hour, and the Harvey thing was a monster amount of money, an incredible amount of money. You know that this is something that you can mobilize at any time, and so far it seems, from an outsider's perspective, it seems like it's pretty piecemeal. It's like, this lady helped me up in the parking lot, this happened, okay, let's do some good deeds. Do you have long-term thoughts to, oh, I could like run a foundation and raise like $5 million or whatever, like, are there any grander ambitions, or do you think it might keep going on for a while on the piecemeal, like, this got to me, I'm going to keep doing this?
I think it's going to stay that way.
Yeah?
Because I did start to think about, especially after the Harvey stuff, and it was like $134,000 in a few hours.
Yeah.
I was like, this is a real thing. First of all, this is a very scary thing.
Yeah.
But it's a real thing, and should we be doing some sort of organization, some sort of nonprofit?
Yeah.
But ultimately, that just felt counterintuitive to just the way everything is sort of run, because again, it's all just a thing happened and we'll respond to that thing. It doesn't work, I think, as well or as meaningfully if it's just always in place and sort of always going. So no, I think it'll stay the way that it is, and we'll help out wherever we can or whatever it feels like the right time to.
Are people like pitching you now because they know that this is something that you can do?
All day.
Yeah?
All day, every day.
It's so hard to say no or to not answer or whatever.
Yeah,
like, what
it's
do you
really,
do?
It's really hard. Mostly I just will respond. Like, more times than not, it's a GoFundMe thing.
Yeah.
Oh, I started a GoFundMe for Puerto Rico.
Can you tweet it or
whatever? Can you tweet it out? Yeah. And it's like, no, I'm not going to do that, because why would I tweet your GoFundMe when I can send people to the actual a thing that I know is going to help Puerto Rico legit.
Yeah.
If I give you the money, then you're just going to send it to the same place.
Right.
And we're going to lose a percentage of it because GoFundMe takes it along the way.
Yeah.
But so I try to stay away from that sort of thing. And then also I did a GoFundMe a while back, and I got burned on it.
Oh.
It was like, this person said they set it up because a child of a person I knew passed away. So, like a friend of the family or something set up a GoFundMe to do the funeral. And I was helping out there, and then that person just kept the money. And it was like, you know, several thousand dollars. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to do that anymore. So I try to stay away from that sort of stuff. But, yeah, all day long, people are sending it in. And I just try to be sensitive of the situation or as respectful as possible. And more times than not, people are cool about it. Like, they send me a GoFundMe thing, and I say, oh, I'm not going to do that because I got burned on this other one. They're like, oh, okay, cool. Well, I appreciate appreciate it.
Okay.
And then that's all it is. Like, everybody is, for the most part, everybody is very, very cool about everything. Again, if you're taking the time to respond, then that's really all anybody is looking for. If you just straight up are ignoring people,
yeah,
then that's hard, which I try not to do, but I'm sure I have at some point.
Three more. I'm also dad of twins.
Yeah.
It's a club. It's a thing. What's it like? I have my opinions. What's it like the first year when you're just, it's you, and you got the twins, you're trying to make it work, and then now that they're older, does that feel super different than just like, you know, your friends who have a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old and all that?
Right. The first year it was crazy, but crazy. You don't realize how crazy it is because you've never done it before.
Yeah.
Like, if you just start out with twins, then you're just like, this is what normal is.
Yeah.
And you figure it out. And when we ended up having another baby after that, then it was like, oh shit, that was way harder with the twins.
You know, well, yeah.
It was much more difficult. But as far as now, once they got to, like, I don't know, 2 years old or something, and they became aware of each other, because when they're babies, they don't know anything. They're not like, oh, another baby. That's not how babies work. But once they got to like 2 or 3 and they started playing with each other, then it was cool, because then they were just sort of on their own.
Yeah.
All the time. Even now, they can be together for like 20 hours straight and not bother me at all.
Yeah.
Besides, they need some food or something.
Yeah.
So it's easy now. It's not a thing. It does very much feel like they're just friends, super friends all the time together. And it sucks for the baby because he's sort of left out of that group.
He's super smart and fun, and I got to meet him, and like, yeah, he's great.
He's way smarter than they are.
Is that right?
And like at their age, he's going to be 5 in a few
years. Oh, yeah, he's smart. I wasn't sure how old he was. He's freaking smart.
Yeah, he's much more intelligent than they were idiots. I think because they were only around each other, so
yeah,
they were just like that level. But he's always trying to keep up with them. So, yeah, as far as raising twins, it sucks in the beginning, but it's easy after that.
Second to last, what did you love about teaching, and would you consider going back in some form as a guest lecturer or something like that? Because you've talked about it and you've said how much you loved it. Obviously,
yeah,
it's not as lucrative as writing at the high levels can be, but would you give that? Jay Adonde punted everything and went to Northwestern. Like, this stuff happens. Would you consider...
Did you really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's gone. He was doing both. He was with ESPN, and I'm pretty sure now he's just back at Northwestern full time, and he's just doing that.
That's great.
Jay is one of the greatest MBA writers of our generation.
Yeah. Yeah, I would go back. I would like to eventually go back to teaching.
Yeah.
Once I don't have to pay all of the bills that
yeah, right,
we had to pay. Because that's hard. Teachers make, in Houston, 45, 50 grand a year.
Yeah, and to be a tenured professor is like a whole other ball of wax that requires a career path. Yeah.
And I would never go back and do that. Like, if I went, when I go back to teaching, it will be at like the middle school level.
Okay.
The Title I school.
Yeah.
That's the job that I want. As far as what I loved about it, it was a job that just made me feel important. It was like, it was immediately affecting people just by going to work every day.
Yeah.
Is what it felt like. And it was easy to see in that situation. Now we can like raise a bunch of money and give it away, and like I get a nice email back or something like that, or a couple of pictures, and it's like, cool. But, and I'm sure it helped a lot of people,
sure,
but in the, you know, if I'm teaching, I can see myself helping this one kid, and it's that, like, that sort of relationship was very meaningful to me. So yeah, I would like to go back eventually. Not right now.
So last question, which I do at the end of every podcast, is I always ask the guests for a life tip, like a nugget of wisdom, whatever. And I've never felt more confident in my life of what a life tip is going to be. But if that's actually the one, then just spell it out and why it's important, or it could be something else. I don't know.
No, I'm going to, for my life tip, I'm going to just say, just keep going. That's all you need. I think that's really all you need to do beyond anything else, is just keep on, just keep walking forward. If I think about my writing career, when I started out, there was like, you meet up with other people who are at that same level,
yeah,
that you are. So there was a group of us, 5 or 10 of us, guys and girls, who we were all starting out at the same time. And several of those people, I can comfortably say they were much more talented than I was as far as writing.
Yeah.
But they just stopped going, and they didn't get to where they were trying to go just because they stopped going forward. So I think that's more important than really anything else, more important than talent, more important than connections, is if you just keep showing up, keep doing it, you're going to get to where you want to go.
Well, and I feel like it can overcome tough stuff too if you have a family tragedy or something like that. Like, what else is there to do? Like, if you stop to think about it too much, you're screwed. And it's like, life sucks, but what are you going to do?
Uh-huh.
Well, Shay, a super duper pleasure to meet you. I cannot freaking tell you how excited I am, how things are going for you. But I've never met you, and like, we worked at the same place, but I was just like, holy shit, this guy's killing it. Like, I would like get emotional, and at home I would talk about it, just like, I'm very excited for you. So, mazel tov on everything, man.
Thank you.